This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I didn't want every chapter to just be, oh, look, Jeremy's acting stupid and crazy again. I wanted chapters to show the joy and the wonder and the reason why I keep putting myself in these situations that are very stressful for me.
These dark and troubling times have left very few of us stress and anxiety free. So we thought we'd check in with an expert on germophobia and anxiety. No, our guest this week on Sea Change Radio is not a psychologist. He's an environmental journalist, writer for Manga Bay, and longtime friend of the show, Jeremy Hance. Hance has struggled with mental illness and anxiety for decades and recently wrote a book documenting his travails. Baggage, Confessions of a Globe-Trotting Hypochondriac, is brave, thoughtful, and often quite hilarious. Our discussion with Hance may just give you a different perspective the next time you read an investigative piece that takes place in some exotic locale. Perhaps it will also lend perspective as we all struggle with our own negative thoughts and uneasiness. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeremy Hance. He's an environmental journalist and an author, and his new book is called Baggage, Confessions of a Globe-Trotting Hypochondriac. Jeremy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So this is a different sort of angle from your normal environmental reporting. Why don't you first explain to us what motivated you to write this, grappling with a lot of the mental health issues that you've had to confront, and here you kind of reveal yourself to your readers.
Yes, I do. I definitely reveal myself for good or for ill. You know, it's funny to think that people who know me as an environmental journalist will suddenly get to, if they read this book, will get to know me in a very different way.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been a journey. When I was, I've been struggling with mental health issues since I was 10 years old. So about 30 years now. And for most of my life, it was not something I would ever think of. I would never have thought I would have written a book about my mental health experience. That's like the furthest thing I ever wanted to do. But I think as I got older and I had these amazing opportunities as an environmental journalist to do these trips, I started to really see that there was a unique story there, and a funny story. And my impetus, I guess, has really been that I think, you know, people who deal with mental health issues, it's such a difficult daily grind for many of us, if you're dealing with chronic mental health, that I wanted to write a book where people could read it and maybe feel a little less alone, maybe enjoy some of the adventures, maybe learn a little bit more about how mental illness affects people, and at the same time, hopefully laugh a little and have some entertainment. So I didn't want it to be a downer of a book. I wanted it to be a book that really captured the complexity of living with mental illness, and that sometimes, you know, when you're traveling especially, can get you into some very silly situations. But I really wanted to kind of tell that story and tell a mental health story from a different perspective than a lot of times that it's told, and try and capture sort of my own story, but try and make it relevant to people who either live with mental health issues themselves or those who have loved ones who have had mental health problems. I mean, I feel like this book could maybe be a good way for them to kind of understand a little bit more about how the inner workings of mental health, panic attacks, anxiety, depression, can kind of work inside someone's mind. I really tried to sort of do a few scenes where I focus on that. But at the same time, I wanted to tell the stories of these trips where I get to run around and see beautiful animals and experience incredible places and meet new people and all the things that anybody who reads travel writing loves about travel writing. So I kind of tried to mix all those things together, and it came out as a very, I think, different book, and hopefully one that people will both enjoy, but also maybe learn something or get a new perspective on mental health and on nature.
Well, it's an unabashed success. And I think that when you look at what appeals to readers about travel writing is usually the places themselves. But I kept thinking of this as like a Paul Theroux meets Larry David, when you have like, you know, I've read
through and really enjoyed, you know, riding the Iron Rooster and the Patagonia Express, his travel writing on trains. And he gets into some self-reflection, but I don't feel like I know the man, and I don't know his foibles and his deepest anxieties. So it's more about the place, and you get a feel for the place. So that's kind of like a nice confluence of those two worlds. It's like a personal memoir, but you're also revealing a lot about the places that you get to.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that, you know, that's one thing that we all love about travel writing, right, is the experience to go to these places through the written page, places that most of us will probably never get to, or you know, if it's travel writing written 50, 100 years ago, it's wonderful to visit these places as they used to be. But of course, as I was exploring this from a sort of my mental health aspect, I knew that I was going to insert myself more than a lot of travel writers do. And part of the humor there is that I'm an awful traveler. Not all the time. Like I've practiced enough now and done enough that I think I'm a very nice person when I'm traveling usually, but I have panic attacks. I have days that are really bad, and I can get myself into really ridiculous situations. So I wanted to sort of touch on that because I think a lot of travel writing is written by really good travelers. It's written by people who can handle the culture shock, who can deal with the language changes, who can deal with sort of the daily anxieties and stress of travel. And I wanted to sort of write it from perspective of someone who is really not that way. And I think a lot of people who travel might be able to, at least to a certain extent, be able to understand that feeling, you know, the feeling you get when you're on an airplane and you're starting to get a little nervous if there's a little jet, you know, you hit a jet stream and the plane's starting to bounce around, or the feeling that you get when you're in a new place and you're experiencing culture shock for some of the first time. You know, those kind of things are real. And I just wanted to dive into that a bit more. Not to say that other travel writing isn't, I love other travel writing. Like, I like to read travel books that are by really good travelers because I get to experience what it would be like if I was a good traveler instead of the way I really am. But I thought it was a different way of looking at it and of sort of acknowledging and recognizing that it's okay when we travel to feel anxiety. It's normal. Like, it's okay. Like, you can have a bad day when you travel, and it doesn't mean that the trip is in any way ruined or that you didn't get anything out of it. I think in some ways the best trips for me have been ones where I've had, at least in the moment, some of the most difficult times. So it's really about that kind of that journey and what travel and experiencing these places can mean in looking back and in the long run.
As a host of an environmental radio show and podcast, I speak to countless journalists and writers who expose these stories all around the world, but we really don't usually get into how did you get to this remote island in Thailand and tell us for 10 minutes how the logistics of that travel. And we kind of skip over that part. But for the writer itself, that's a huge part of it logistically, right? Is figuring out how the heck am I going to get from A to B?
For sure. That's a huge part of it. And a lot of, you know, a lot of the book I write is like, you know, each chapter is sort of a different trip, or there's like two chapters for one trip sometimes, but they're sort of these snippets. But a lot of times, a lot of the chapter is about getting there, you know, like what is it like to drive on the roads in Sumatra? Not that I was driving, thank God, because I'd be dead if I was. Or what is it like to, you know, do have a panic attack on a transatlantic flight? You know, what is it like to actually get to these sort of remote places? And then sharing the experience of the amazing time you have there and why you kind of put yourself through the challenges and the travel of getting to these often remote places.
Yes, you write about in Peru, when you're finally in the Amazon rainforest, you can kind of take a deep breath. And then you're like, that's your happy place. The happy place is not leaving the house and going to the airport. That's the scary part for you.
Yes, 100%. Like the worst part of most of my trips are on planes, in cars. Like it's once I get there and I can get some sleep and catch up on my jet lag, and once I get to the destination, especially a place like the Amazon, one of my points of the book is to show that, like, just because you deal with mental health issues, you know, it's not an all the time, everyday thing for a lot of people. It goes up and down in waves, and it's how you kind of deal with it. And I didn't want every chapter to just be, oh, look, Jeremy's acting stupid and crazy again. I wanted chapters to show the joy and the wonder and the reason why I keep putting myself in these situations that are very stressful for me.
So, Jeremy, you were talking about the challenges of presenting your anxieties and mental health issues to the reader. Can you take us inside that process a little bit of going from a 10-year-old and confronting your mother's mental health issues, and your father also suffered from depression, you mentioned, going from like the couch of a therapist to putting this out for the world to read?
Sure. I mean, it's been a long process and a long journey. I mean, when I was I was sort of first diagnosed with depression and anxiety as a 10-year-old. After my mom had essentially a breakdown.
Sorry to interrupt, but yes, you write, and I thought it was pretty humorous. You're like, well, if my mom's going to be catatonic and depressed, so am I. It was kind of like you were showing some solidarity there.
I was. And that's, I mean, you know, memory is a funny thing because I'm not sure, you know, it's difficult to know exactly what was going through my subconscious or my conscious at that time. But that's how my memory kind of looks at it. I was super close to my mother. Still am. And so when she fell apart out of kind of nowhere from my perspective, I just sort of went with her. And I was and am a very sensitive person, and I feel people's emotions keenly. So having her go through that, I just sort of went too. But because I was growing up in a pretty small town, a conservative community, and because this was basically the early 90s, 1990, I was really felt ashamed, and I hid it from everybody I could. So I went through this whole long period of a lot of my life where I felt a lot of shame around my mental illness. And then I got to a point, I think, in my 20s where I was like, screw that, I don't really care. Like, I'm just, you know, I became more open, at least with friends and loved ones. But I'm still not someone who's going to like bring it up at a dinner table. Like I've learned over the years, I've been hardened. And as most people who deal with chronic mental illness, I think have, especially if you start with as a child, is you learn how to pretend. You learn how to hide it. I could be experiencing a pretty bad mental health day, and then I'll show up at your house for a dinner party, and you would have no idea. You know, you learn to act. So sharing this vulnerability, sharing this sort of this deeply personal part of myself wasn't an easy decision, but it just kept feeling like it was the right step for me, and it kept feeling like it was a story that I could actually tell, and one that I wanted to tell, which was a weird, because usually, like I said, my first instinct of like talking about my own mental illness is like, ew, yuck, you know, you don't want to hear about that. But I think that allowing that doing it through the lens of travel, doing it through the lens of nature, and doing it as something that was hopefully humorous and more entertaining was a way to sort of share the story and still maybe to a certain extent protect some of the more vulnerable bits of me. And do it in a way that I think was maybe most useful for people. So that's kind of what happened. And I just, you know, it's like with any book, I think most writers will tell you, it's not so much that you decide to write the book. It's like the book decides you're going to write it. Like the book just, you can't shake it. You become, I mean, for a lack of a better term, obsessed. Like my OCD will always tell me I get obsessed with certain things. And this book I became obsessed with. And it just sort of became inevitable at a certain point. And you know, I was going to do it come hell or high water, and then went through the whole journey of finding an agent and publisher. And now pretty soon it'll be out in the world, and people, will see a very, different side of me. And it's going to be interesting, I think, for my own personal self to see, you know, so far most of the responses have been just great. So that's great. But, you know, I know that not everyone is going to maybe, appreciate it. So that's fine. I'll have to learn to deal with that.
This is the place you end up when you lose the chase, where you're dragged against your will from a basement on the hill. And all anybody knows is you're not like them, and they kick you in the head and send you back to bed. Isolation pulled you past a tunnel to a bright world where you can make a place to stay. But everybody's scared of this place and staying away. Your little house on memory lane. The mayor's name is Fear. His force patrols the pier from a mountain of cliché that advances every day. The doctor spoke a cloud. He rained out.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental journalist and author Jeremy Hantz, whose new book is Baggage, Confessions of a Globetrotting Hypochondriac. Can you give us a better idea of how manageable is it in terms of being a quote-unquote productive member of society from 10 years old on, in terms of how did it hinder your education and your work history? And do you think this book will help you manage it more effectively moving forward?
Sure. I mean, it's a lifetime journey of managing. I will probably be on medication the rest of my life. I will probably never stop seeing therapists. I have a very good therapist now, which is great. I do have 30 years of experience, so the managing is, you know, certainly better than when I was a teenager. But it's a lifetime process, and the way it's affected sort of my work and my life is like I have a really hard time working sort of what someone would consider a normal full-time job. I've never been able to really do that for very long. I did it at Mongan Bay for a number of years, and that was the longest. I need a lot more sleep than a lot of people. I have days where I just, you know, every few weeks I'll have a couple days where I'm just not really that functional. it's really learning about learning your own limits and learning what you can do and can't do, learning to take care of yourself. I've learned over the years, I have multiple, what you could call tools in a toolbox to sort of take care of myself when I can feel the OCD or the depression creeping up on me. So I've definitely learned to manage it. I mean, I have a loving, wonderful relationship with my wife. I have a wonderful daughter. I feel like, you know, I'm productive to a certain extent, but it's not easy, and it's definitely a daily struggle, and I never know when I kind of wake up in the morning like, okay, will today be a normal day, or will today be a day in which I'm going to have to give up on the idea of really getting anything useful done, and I'll have to like kind of, you know, put myself in the bedroom and let my wife kind of handle things, and those days do happen. So, and you know, I think as you get older too, it's always a different and evolving process, but I've been very fortunate to have a very loving, wonderful family. I've been very fortunate to have my wife. I've been very fortunate in many ways. I have a wonderful therapist. So those things all help. It would be disastrous if some of those support systems weren't there. But at the same time, it's one of those things like any chronic illness that I don't think I'll ever get rid of it. You know, I don't think I'll ever be like, oh, I'm cured, you know? That's just not going to happen. So it's a constant kind of management, and it's a constant knowing my own limits and what I'm capable of.
Well, when it comes to the phobias that you encounter with traveling, the OCD and the fear of sickness, the rest of the world is catching up to you when it comes to the pandemic. It seems like this is very timely in a lot of ways. For 20, 30 years, you probably felt maybe insecure about these anxieties, but now being a germaphobe is something that's admirable in today's world. It's downright polite to be super afraid and vigilant.
Yeah.
That's changed very suddenly, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. And it's been an interesting experience as someone who's lived with these kind of anxieties and OCD around health issues, is particularly to watch this unfold. And I've had some friends who have said, oh my God, you know, now that they're starting to feel so much anxiety around COVID-19, they're like, I understand more what you've gone through, Jeremy. And I'm like, yeah, I guess you kind of do. Like, I'm sorry. Like, this is not what I wanted for the world or any of us. But I do think that, you know, people with OCD and with these kind of issues have maybe some deep wisdom all of a sudden. It's a strange place to be in. It's not anything I really ever expected. On the one hand, you know, we have this disease that trips my own anxieties as it's tripping everybody's. So I'm obviously been struggling with that on and off. But at the same time, because I've spent so many years now sort of managing my anxieties and learning how to control them and learning what's, you know, what is a real anxiety, what's real and what's like an imagined, I've also felt like I've had a little bit more armor than some people. Mm-hmm. And that I can kind of look at this with a little bit more like, okay, you know, this is just the way the world is. We're adapting. All right. We're going to wear masks. We're going to wash our hands. We're going to stay 6 feet apart. Like, I can do this, you know? So it's been interesting to watch people really struggle with that. You know, it's something that's like, I mean, I was wearing masks before wearing masks became inevitable, at times, you know?
Yeah, and if you spend any time in Japan or other Asian countries, you've seen people walking around with masks all the time. I remember seeing it when I first got there in the early 90s, wondering, why do those people have masks on? And I remember my Japanese friends telling me, they may not be sick, but they don't want to get other people sick. So it's just a polite thing.
It's a community thing, right? And I think because of that part of the world has dealt with these diseases cropping up more frequently than we have. And I think also that there's just in certain parts of the world, in certain countries, there's a better, healthier sense of community and of looking out for each other. That just became like a normal thing there. And I think as Americans, we're all kind of now struggling with, okay, we're supposed to wear masks. Like, what does this mean? What is this, you know? And it's in some ways because we've just sort of, we haven't had to do this since the Spanish influenza. And so we're all kind of, and also I think America struggles with its idea of community and what a community is. As someone with OCD, it's both awful, like this is horrible for us. And at the same time, I do think that like people who have lived with anxiety or OCD might have a little bit of, you know, a little tougher skin sort of. We've been scarred enough that like our skin is just, okay, you know, this is what we're doing now. We're more adaptable to that sense. And we're more, maybe have some wisdom to share and like, in the sense of, you know, hey, let's take this seriously. Like it's clear from the experts that this is very serious. You know, we're almost close to 1 million deaths worldwide. We're getting close to 200,000 deaths in the US. This isn't, you know, this is real. It's not a joke. And there are very pretty easy things that we can all do to just help keep each other safe and keep each other comfortable. And like with someone with mental illness and OCD and anxiety around those things, that's like, I'll do that 100% all the time because I have those anxieties already tripped in. I'm a cautious person. I'm a sensitive person. So for me, it's been a very, the minute they said wear masks, I was like, all right, you know, here's all our masks. And,
it was easy to rise to the occasion for you.
Yes, it was because I that's just sort of my personality type. And I understand that other people, are not that way. And I get it. Like it's more of a struggle for some people and, you know, that makes sense, but it was very easy. And I think for a lot of people who struggle with anxiety, that part of this pandemic has been pretty simple to be like, oh, I'm supposed to wear masks or I'm supposed to wash my hands or stay home. Like, okay, you know, I want to keep myself safe and I want to keep my loved ones safe and the community safe. You know, I want to do my part. So, you know, there is some wisdom to that. But as with anything with mental health issues, you can obviously take it too far and you don't want to be one of those people who this spirals you down. And I'm sure I know, you know, that has happened, you know, spirals you into a great deep depression or spirals you into panics and stuff. And so, you know, I think everyone with mental health issues or people who don't even have that are really struggling to find ways to manage those very normal and real anxieties.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental journalist and author Jeremy Hance, whose new book is called Baggage, Confessions of a Global Trotting Hypochondriac. And it comes out in October, incidentally. So we were talking about some of the precautions that we have to take now with the pandemic, but there are a lot of similar precautions that a traveler like yourself has to take when they go into new countries with foreign microbes and bacteria for your body to reject. Why don't you draw some parallels for us, if you will?
Sure. And I think that's I hadn't thought about that before, but I think that's a really good point that like I've been doing international travel for, about 20 years now, to some pretty, you know, remote places. And that's just part of the deal. Like you, and so maybe that's another reason too, why this pandemic has been somewhat like, oh, we need to do this. Okay. Typically what I'll do is I'll go see a travel doctor or I'll see a doctor with some travel experience and we'll just kind of go through, okay, what do you need? What's this? I always make sure I bring stuff for medicine for traveler's diarrhea. If there's any chance of malaria, you know, I do it. I tend to go with the recommended stuff and then push further. Like, you know, some places will require certain vaccines. I get pretty much every vaccine that, you know, fits the bill for what I'll be doing and where I'll be doing it. For example, I'll shell out, you know, a lot of money to get a Japanese encephalitis vaccine, even though that might be incredibly rare where I am. But I just, in order to do these trips and not have panic attacks, I need to like make sure that I've done all my research and kind of have every vaccine and all the pills that I need and stuff.
Yes, you make a list when you go to Peru of all the ways that you could die.
Like, yes, exactly. I make a mental list every time I go anywhere of all the ways that I could die. And then I try to mitigate it. And part of that is bonkers. Like, part of that is, that's crazy, Jeremy. But part of it I've also learned is just, you know, to a certain level of it, you have to accept a certain amount of risk whenever you travel. You have to, you know, we all accept a certain amount of risk whenever we get out of bed in the morning. You know, we're mortal creatures. Anything can happen. But when you travel, it's a little extra. And so it's a kind of finding a balance between my OCD and my paranoia, and a balance between not going too far. And it's always riding this thin line, right? But, you know, obviously for other travelers who are a little more chill, I understand not maybe going quite as far as I do, but I still would obviously recommend to people to do the bare basics. You do not want to end up somewhere and get malaria. Malaria is a, you know, we don't really deal with it in the United States, but it can kill you. It kills hundreds of thousands of people every year. So just get the malaria pills, you know, get the vaccines that are recommended for that country, because you just, it's not worth it. It's not worth not doing those very simple things to protect yourself. But also, you know, some of these things are spreadable, and you're protecting others, and you're protecting people that you're traveling with too. And I always recommend to just, you know, make sure you get some good traveler's insurance. Again, it's about peace of mind. It's about having something that, like, if something should go wrong, you have to spend more money than you expected, or if you end up in a hospital, you don't have to worry about paying those bills. To the same extent, you know, you can have some, and you have a contact then too, who the good traveler insurance companies have places that you can reach out to and talk to somebody who specializes in kind of making sure you're safe and secure and getting you home and, you know, well and everything. So, you know, those are all things that I really suggest people do when we travel. And those are, like you said, those are kind of things that we're all starting to have to do this year, with COVID, is thinking about, what do I need in my house? What do I need on hand?
You can have that globe-trotting travel experience without leaving your own community now.
Exactly. Now we can all experience what it's like to be an international traveler. Woohoo! Without having the joy of maybe, you know, being able to see lions in the wild.
I think that might be one of the reasons why the anti-maskers reject so much of this. These are the same people who probably wouldn't go to a country where you couldn't drink the water.
Oh, yeah. Since this is an environmental show and I'm an environmental journalist, we take for granted having clean, relatively, for most of us, good water in the U.S. Obviously, there's been issues, terrible issues in Flint, Michigan, and I worry that that's going to continue to happen. And that's only because of environmental regulations that we have. You know, we can turn on our faucet and not have to worry too much about what's coming out. But a lot of players in the world, they've already lost that freedom and that right. And so that's something to really be aware of, because it is challenging and frightening to think that, you know, not knowing what's in your water, whether it be microbes or whether it be pollutants.
The book is called Baggage: Confessions of a Globetrotting Hypochondriac. Jeremy Hantz. Jeremy, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Queen with David Bowie and Elliot Smith. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.